All over this world, people are dreaming of the country they left. In the next hour, three stories about how the heart yearns for the place it was born. Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio, from NPR, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm independent producer Nina Ellis, and today we visit the old country. Europeans call it that, but we all understand it's the place we left, and we all know that feeling. Please, just let me go there one more time. In the 1970s, thousands of Vietnamese fled their country for the United States. They made new lives here, in communities from coast to coast. But for so many of them, like Nguyen Quy Duc, home is always somewhere else.
My uncle just died. It was cold even inside the funeral home as the monks prayed. A heart attack killed him at 75. He was just 45 when he left Vietnam, coming to America, responsible for a wife, three kids, a stepmother, and me. I was 17 and without my parents, so at the end of the Vietnam War, my uncle took me with him. Saved my life, really. An hour after we cremated him, a blizzard turned Maryland, where he lived, pristine white. It was a strange landscape. I'd left my uncle soon after I came to America and drifted around California. As a kid, I grew up in a time of war. Before I became a teenager, America had already come to my country. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, or The Doors. That was what I understood America to be. But the music came with men in army fatigues. Hundreds of them tore throughout town in central Vietnam, their trucks noisy, dusty, their rifles a scary sight. The year I turned 10, things really changed. Tet, the Lunar New Year, had arrived, but the sound of firecrackers celebrating the Year of the Monkey in 1968 was replaced by gunfire and explosions. North Vietnamese troops invaded several cities in the south. In the city of Hue, where our family was on holiday, thousands died in a month of house-to-house fighting. Thousands disappeared, among them my father. It would be 16 years before I saw him again. I carried on with school, but for years my father's absence loomed over us, and the war grew worse.
The end came quickly on April 30th, 1975, as helicopters landed on the embassy roof, leaving behind hundreds of Vietnamese citizens within the embassy walls.
When the war ended in 1975, an estimated 3 million Vietnamese had died. America was mourning the 58,000 it had lost, and would come to relive the nightmare of defeat for years. Vietnam plunged into extreme poverty.
Welcome to America, and welcome to Camp Pendleton. At this time, I need each of you to move to the Quonset hut.
About 100,000 Vietnamese ended up as refugees in America, including my uncle, his family, and myself. The churches, charities, and families that sponsored us did all they could to welcome us and create physical comfort. What they couldn't give us was a sense of home. At 17, I was riding the bus to school and always feeling the gaze of others. It was as if they could see the shame of defeat on my back and the guilt of having left my parents and a sister behind. For the first couple of years, we had no news of home, but we eventually learned to live with our pain. People I knew were getting married, building new families, new identities. At some point, we began to accept that we were Asian Americans. Time passes, we spoke more and more English, and then came time to apply for American citizenship. A sensible thing to do, but we did it with a measure of shame. Being American seemed a betrayal of our roots, our nation, our real selves.
Hello. Kính chào quý thính giả. Đây là chương trình 30 phút thông tin văn hóa và nghệ thuật Việt Nam do Tổ chức Việt Nam Truyền thông chủ trương và thực hiện. Chương trình này được phát thanh mỗi trưa chủ nhật từ 1 giờ đến 1 giờ 30 trên băng tần KUSF 90.3 FM.
I ended up in Northern California with a radio show for the Vietnamese that had formed a community here. We were settling down roots in our little Saigons, replenished by the arrival of boat people, those who risked their lives escaping from communism.
Tình khúc cho em của Lê Nguyên Phương.
Watch one of their popular entertainment videos now. You would know these are people who'd been in labor camps, who'd lived in near hunger in the 80s, and who'd escaped on boats across the Pacific. It's estimated that between a third to half of those who left this way died at sea. After 12 years in prison camps, my dad was sent home, and 4 years later came to America with my mom. My sister had died. She too was cremated, her ashes placed in an urn and left with monks in Saigon, now renamed Ho Chi Minh City. My parents settled in San Francisco. We learned to be a family again. They never thought of going back to Vietnam. I was desperate too. They were afraid of all sorts of danger. Prison and the years of communism had done terminal damage. I went back to Vietnam nearly 15 years after coming to America. No American dream could hold me back. Home was home, and I pined for it. I found former classmates and the old home, but the country had changed, and I had changed. In a temple in Ho Chi Minh City, I cried and cried. I'd found my sister's ashes. I sat with the monks for a while, and then I brought her ashes to the United States. The family was whole again. The Vietnamese in America still carry some wounds, but there's a generation born here that's graduated from college. In corporate boardrooms, on TV, and in government offices, there are Vietnamese faces. In their homes, they've set up altars with pictures of the ancestors, remembrance of the dead and the past. I can't stay away from Vietnam. Since leaving, I've been back 20 times, sliding back into the old culture, like a jewel thief into his favorite velvet gloves. 30 years ago, I followed an uncle and crossed the Pacific. The ocean separated us from our birthplace. Millions of Vietnamese have died. Millions have survived. Some in one country, some in another. And some of us cross back and forth. A month before he passed away, my uncle visited Vietnam for the first time in 30 years. The family thinks the long trip, the dire conditions, and the terrible shape of his childhood home finally did him in. My aunt thinks of bringing his ashes home in a few years. Maybe he's there already, in the way that we Vietnamese think of how souls can travel to a birthplace. I fly back and forth, the ocean beneath the wings of the airplane, beneath the clouds. I'll visit my uncle's ashes wherever. The ocean doesn't separate. It connects my two homes.
Home is Always Somewhere Else was produced by Nguyen Quy Duc with music by Daron Cravan for the Asian American History Series CrossingEast.org. I'm Nina Ellis. You're listening to Hearing Voices. I was born in Chicago, where my grandfather settled when he came from Sholta, an island in the Adriatic, in 1913 as a stowaway. I didn't know him well. He barely spoke English, and he died when I was a kid. But I do know he was deeply homesick for most of his life. So 15 years ago, during the war in the Balkans, I went back there to try to understand why my grandfather had left in the first place. I call this story, The Old Country is Gone. When I was a small child, I would stay overnight sometimes with my grandparents in Chicago. I called them Nana and Dida. In the morning, the radio was tuned to a Croatian language station, and Nana would cook farina just for me. I would sit next to Dida and watch him pour hot milk and coffee over his Cheerios. On birthdays and holidays, friends and relatives came over, laughing, telling stories, and drinking Dida's homemade wine. They all talked wistfully about the Stari Kraj, the old country, the beautiful island they'd left behind. I came to believe that the Stari Kraj was paradise, where the kitchen table was always full of wine and strudel, where children sat on the laps of warm, buxom women with pierced ears, and where the men sang in harmony. When I sang the Croatian songs, everyone would cheer. I had no idea how much it meant to them, how homesick they were. My grandparents, their names were Riketa and Nikola, came to this country in the great Eastern European migration. They met in Chicago, married, and had two children, first a daughter, and then, in 1929, a son named Leonard.
Hi, Nina. This is your dad. How's it going, babe? Sorry I missed you. Happy, happy. Have a good day. Doodly doodly.
This is my dad. He's almost always like this, spunky and optimistic. He's told me over and over again about my grandfather and the lessons he learned from him. First, it doesn't cost anything to say hello. And second, hard work is good.
And there was always this comparison. This is beautiful. Oh, yes, I can see that's beautiful here, but you ought to see what we have at home. Isn't that a beautiful flower? We have nicer flowers. Isn't that a beautiful ocean? Our ocean is clearer. You should see the Adriatic. You should see our island. All that was, it was constant, it was a comparison.
Last fall, my dad and I decided to go to the island together. We'd both been there before, but not since the war in Croatia began. I arranged to meet my dad in the city of Split on the coast. He got off the plane with my brother Lee, who'd never been there. My dad and Lee were so excited when they arrived, but Split was tense and full of soldiers. There was fighting 30 miles away. The next morning at sunrise, we got on a ferry boat and headed for Sholta, the island Nikola had left. As I watched the island grow closer, I knew my grandfather must have stood on a boat deck and looked back toward home, where he'd left 10 brothers and sisters behind.
Are you excited?
Yeah, I'm kind of excited. Always I'm excited because it's always different. Sometimes, each time it seems to be sadder, too.
Why?
Well, because there's somebody else missing, and now there's nobody, almost, as there was when we first went there in 61. It was a big crowd, and that's different, sadder.
No one met us at the boat when we arrived. We hadn't written that we were coming, so we caught the bus and headed for Rina's. The island of Sholta rises up out of the sea, and it's small enough to walk from end to end in a day. It's mostly open land, small farm plots with olive trees, fig trees, and grapevines. The soil is reddish and full of white rocks. It's a stark, simple beauty here. Bright blue sky, the blue-green sea, the smell of wild rosemary, the white stone houses. We went to the town of Stamorska, where Rina has a small restaurant and hotel. Sholta's been quiet since Rina and the others shot down those planes 2 years ago, but the war is killing her business, she says. Tourism is dead. The local people have no money to spend. Things are very tough. Rena lives in the port town my grandfather left from 80 years ago. He would have walked here from his village just over the hill. His mother probably came to see him off. She was pregnant and his father had just died, so Nicola was the man of the family when he left for America at just 16 years old. He promised her he would be back before long. It was 1914. My grandfather's life began unfolding for me, backwards through time as we got closer to his home. Walking on the road to the village, my father remembered the first time he'd come this way.
This is a road I traversed the first time I came up here, back 32 years ago. I came up here in the dark. It was pitch black.
He knew the road by heart the first time he went because he'd heard about it all his life from my grandfather. He got up as far as the church and stopped.
I didn't know where I was going then. Then I was dead, shot dead right there, and I said... Now, there's got to be, I remember hearing about, there was always a bunch of old men who would sit around by a little park near the church. So I hollered out to them if anybody here knew the family and where they were. And a man came over. He says, well, who are you? And I told him where I was here, and I was here from America. And he says, who are you looking for? And I told him the family name, and he says, there's so many of those. They also go by nicknames. So he says, which ones? And I said, Pincholovi. And when I said that, he knew immediately who I was talking about. You can see the bench sitting there. And if there's any old men left in this town, they'll be sitting there tonight. But I got this far, and he says, sure, follow me. And he took me down around the, right down here, down the road. And off to the left.
And down winding streets, between the buildings, toward my grandfather's house, which is where his brother Dominic lived until he died 3 years ago.
This is the old homestead. We're going to see Aunt Clementine, who is here. She is the wife of Dominic.
Aunt Clementine, here I am.
Hey! That's not there. Why, Leonard? No,
you know that I'm Leonard? How could I not? This is my daughter and my son.
This is Barbara. This is Uncle Dominic's wife.
Aunt Clementine is in her mid-80s. She's breathing heavily and limping badly. We sit and talk. A few people come by and we get caught up on who's alive, who's moved away, how old everyone is now. We reminisce about our past visits and take some pictures. And just as we're leaving, a cousin named Visco stops by and starts lecturing my father about the failures of American democracy. I didn't come here to talk politics. I came here to see my people, my father said, and he was a little angry. We left my Aunt Clementine's, promising to return later. We wanted to have a look around.
It's beautiful old trees down this path. What you're looking at here to the right, these are olive trees. Olive trees.
As we walked, we could see the village in front of us, the church steeple, the stone houses huddled close together, the fields all around.
When you were a kid, did your father tell you about this area?
Told me all about it. Told me about this island. I knew this island before I knew my own neighborhood. He told me all about it, where he was born, how he grew up, about all of these flagstones, these that make up the walls that you look at, they call ploche. And he would say how they were bloody from the work that went on around them. And you've got to clear so much of it before you got land. Terrible hard job. That's why they always had such great appreciation for the vastness of the open country in the U.S. They see that way. It's almost unbelievable that there was so much open country. You didn't have to clean rocks off of to get...
Mm-hmm. He was 16 when he left here, but he probably did that kind of work,
oh,
too.
Oh, yes, very much so. You start at a young age. And when you're the oldest, you start first. And he talked about his younger brothers and sisters, that they were not big enough or strong enough to do any work. And they still had to carry part of the load. And he would explain to me how they would cry, and him being the oldest, how he tried to help them. Yeah, he did.
My grandfather loved this life, but he had to leave. Nature and politics conspired against him. He had to support the family when his father died. A blight had destroyed the vineyards, and he was in danger of being drafted into the army of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So just before World War I broke out, family members pooled their money and sent Nicola to America to work. Once he got to Chicago, he worked odd jobs, mostly construction labor, and sent half his wages to his mother to support the family. For 40 years, through two world wars and the Depression, he struggled to keep his own family together. But he always sent money home to his mother and dreamed of the day when he would return for good. Late in the day, after we'd seen the whole island, we went to the cemetery.
My grandmother is over on this side over here. I don't know if I can find her anymore, but she was buried here. And I have to tell you that
what's the last name?
When my dad came here the first time in 1953, and the only time since he left, he came here in 53, his first stop was here.
He said goodbye 40 years before and never saw his mother again. And then he must have turned and walked to town to see his brothers and sisters and find out how they were faring under communist rule, to find out what they'd made of themselves. We'll continue this story after a break. Plus, Andrei Codrescu goes back to his homeland, Romania, and looks deep into the eyes of Sibiu when we return with Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to The Old Country from Hearing Voices. I'm Nina Ellis. When my grandfather went back to his home island in 1953, he stopped first at the cemetery to pay his respects, and then he went into the village to see how his brothers and sisters were doing. This is my dad, Leonard Ellis, telling the story.
Well, when he went back in 53, he found out that they weren't doing anything. The country was in a state of flux. The people were starting to feel, oh, if I just sit here, the government's going to take care of me. He started seeing people, not his own family, saying, I had alluded once, told you the story about when he asked, are we ever going to have any fish for dinner? And they said, well, Marka doesn't have any fish. And my dad retort at the time was, you're on an island and you're looking for somebody to bring you fish. This was his feeling that here you are surrounded by fish and you're waiting for somebody to bring it. He started feeling that way, I felt, about the country. They have a rich country, and yet they were waiting for somebody else to do it for them. He lost his feeling when he was there. He saw his family and he saw his brothers were lethargic about get anything done. Everybody was looking to get on the dole. Half day is a work. People at 50 were already retired. Nothing had really progressed. And all those years, I think it was probably very disappointing to him, considering that he'd probably been supporting the family to the best of his ability for maybe 40 years, almost 50 years. And now he comes back and he finds out that they're really not doing anything for themselves, but waiting for somebody else to do something for them. I think he was terribly disappointed. Never talked about going back again. Never wanted to go back. I think he was a very disappointed man after the trip in 53.
My grandfather had always been an idealist and supported liberal causes. He attended labor rallies in Chicago and believed in the equality of blacks. He wanted to join the anti-fascists in Spain, and he supported Tito's struggle for the partisan cause in Yugoslavia. He believed that brotherhood and unity would bring prosperity to the newly formed country. In 1953, he collided with reality. In the evening, we went back to the village to say goodbye to our Aunt Clementine. We went in for a drink, stayed and talked for a while, and took some more pictures. Aunt Clementine taped a message to her two sons in Chicago. And just as it was getting dark, we left. None of us said it out loud, but we were all thinking, it's the last time we'll see her, and soon my father will be the oldest member of the family. We left Sholta and visited two other islands, the places my grandmothers had left behind for Chicago. We had no relatives left there, but friends and their relatives. One morning in a small town, a carpenter was showing us his shop when another man stuck his head in the door to say hello, and before long the men were singing. It was 10 in the morning, and I saw for myself part of what my grandfather had missed so much about island life. We went back to Split and visited more cousins, dining in their homes on the same food my grandmother always served. We stayed until late at night, telling stories and jokes and remembering the uncles and aunts who had passed away. And inevitably, the subject turned to politics. They complained about the war with the Serbs and the Bosnians. They were unhappy with Western Europe. They were pessimistic about the future, and they hated the Serbs. And though we felt sorry for them because their lives are so difficult now, we grew impatient and uncomfortable. We were ready to go home. My father was taught to love the old country, and he really wants to. And so do I. But for us, just like for my grandfather when he returned 40 years ago, the old country is gone.
Do you think you'll go back?
Me? Do I think I'll go back? I don't know. I'm not too excited about going back. I'm at 1953 like my dad. This is a 53 for me. I look at what they have not done and what they're where they are again. In 1993, 40 years later, I don't think they've taken 5 steps forward, which is bad. Mm-hmm. I told some of them, goodbye, you're not going to see me again. Don't talk like that. I said, I'm 65, I don't see any real reason to come back over here. There's too many other places in the world and things I want to do and see. Wasting my time to come back here, get aggravated listening to their same old gripes against the world, against the government, against the this and that. Oh, you don't want that. I don't need it. I'd like to go back and listen to people say, hey, look what I've done today. Look what we're doing. Look where we're going. Look what's going to happen. And you hear all that malarkey about this government, the Serbs versus the Croats, the Macedonians, this and that, that old-timey nonsense, animosities, hatreds. Europe's full of that. And
they in particular, the Balkans in particular, whew, get rid of it. That's when they're going to start progressing, when they start stop hating each other. Then they're going to get along. Then they're going to have something.
What do you think your father left his home when he was a teenager? And he didn't really want to go. He was forced to go by the circumstances. They were hungry, and he was the oldest son, and that was what they decided was the best thing for the family. And he went in good faith, and he did what his family expected him to do. Do you think that that was what he wanted to do? Do you think that at the end that he was glad that he went because of the way things turned out?
Yes, I think he was glad of what had happened, because now he saw his children had the opportunities that the U.S. offered, and the freedom and the education and the opportunities, which as he looks back now, he can see were not in his home. They weren't there.
And the ironic twist was that it turned out better for him than he would have ever imagined.
Absolutely. I don't think he really understood that it had turned out better for him until he had gone back to see the results after all those years. That's when I think he started to realize that it had turned out better for him. Up until that point, it was a waiting game.
He wanted to go back.
I wanted to go back. See what I've done. I planted the seeds. Let's see what has grown. Then I get back and find out that it hasn't grown. It was very, very disappointing. Heartbreaking, I would say.
Bila si mala širinčica, na škandarjol igrali smo se ono. A sada si ponaresla gospojica, bit šuperba je mala si onda prav. Sićaš li se kad smo bili ispod one skalinade? Skalinade od naše kontrade.
You're listening to The Old Country on Hearing Voices. I'm Nina Ellis. Another immigrant story now, this one from Andrei Codrescu, born in Romania. Andrei left his home as a 19-year-old poet. It was 1965, and Romania was suffering in the grip of a monomaniacal communist dictator named Nicolae Ceausescu. People were starving and freezing in their own homes. Andrei made his way to the U.S., became a citizen, started a family, and continued to write and speak out against the Ceausescu regime. One day at a restaurant in San Francisco, the Romanian head of the writers' union whispered a warning. Don't return to Romania as long as you live. You won't live long if you do. But Andrei did return. In 1989, after a dramatic grassroots revolution in Romania, Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife Elena were killed by firing squad on Christmas Day. A few days later, Andrei boarded the Orient Express in Hungary, bound for Bucharest, the Romanian capital. He hadn't been there in 25 years. He brought cigarettes and coffee for bribes, and he was full of nostalgia. He'd missed his friends, his family, the Carpathian Mountains, and his elegant, Gothic hometown in Transylvania called Sibiu. Andrei survived the trip, despite the warnings, and wrote a book about it called The Hole in the Flag. And then in 2003, he went back to keep up with the ongoing changes there. His story, The Eyes of Sibiu, is narrated by Codrescu's friend and traveling companion, independent producer Larry Massett.
Hello? Is this the American Embassy?
My friend Andre travels with a make-believe cell phone.
I would just like to make sure that I have correct information about the earthquake, because I heard that there's an earthquake coming, and I want to make sure that all American citizens will be informed and that you have a good basement for them.
He has a real one, too, but when he gets restless, he grabs the ghost phone and calls up strangers.
He has not a basement? No, not an attic, because it's an earthquake.
Actually, the part about the earthquake is true. Everyone in Bucharest says an earthquake is about to hit. Maybe this is just Romanian pessimism.
Yeah, okay. Well, anybody? Oh, no, just American citizens. That's good. Thank you.
Andre's been an American citizen for 20 years now, and he's lost the local taste for quakes, crashes, and collapses. He thinks we ought to rent a car and get the hell out of town.
The car is new. It has about 4,000 kilometers. It's not hit by anybody. It doesn't have any dents, nicks, cuts, or teeth marks. Is there anything else you should know on the road? Will be stopped for speeding? And
The speed is 90 kilometers from outside the city. And
how fast is that in real terms?
That's how many miles is that? It's kilometers are shorter, so that's about 20.
This is not important how many miles are, because you have in kilometers and you must be careful.
But does anybody drive actually 90, or do they all drive 120?
Maybe if you are not lucky. You pay a lot of bills.
90 kilometers outside the city, my foot. The car guy forgot to mention it's impossible to get outside the city. You can't do it. Bucharest is dressed up to look like Paris with grand boulevards. There's even an Arc de Triomphe. But just beneath the modern dress is a labyrinth of little one-way lanes, cobblestone dead ends, spaghetti-twisted alleys, and grimly determined intersections that insist on repeating themselves over and over like speech impediments no matter which way you go.
Okay, now I think if we go through here, this is the way to... Well, I'm not sure really, because it seems to lose the road here. That wouldn't get us anywhere. Let me see now. Which way is north?
At some point after driving for several hours, I realize we have just passed by the car rental agency for the third or fourth time. Never mind, Andre says. Just be glad we haven't run into the dogs yet.
Those dogs, man. Bucharest had a wild reputation for wild dogs. There were tens of thousands of wild dogs in Bucharest. They were threatening in large gangs. There were divided feelings about what to do with the dogs, because people of Bucharest loved the dogs and they were feeding them, despite the fact that there were so many people terrified of them. Most people love them, and so quietly the last mayor of Bucharest decided to eliminate the dogs, But the smart dogs, the ones who know, the dogs who haven't trusted people since about their great-grandfather dog time, they started inhabiting empty lots at the edges of the city. So it's entirely possible to drive into a cul-de-sac and meet gangs of dogs that are quite hostile to humans, who know humans, who know what humans are capable of, and their eyes are red and their fur is standing, and they have not just hostility but an articulate hostility, and they are hungry and they look like they like human flesh very much. So you better not go there. We better not go there.
On the other side of the dogs, 300 miles on the other side of the dogs, is the Black Sea. Andre's never seen it. He comes from the mountains, and his family was too poor to go to the beach. But he's thought about it a lot. Constanza, the port, is where the poet Ovid was exiled after he got on the wrong side of Caesar Augustus. Here, Ovid wrote his sad poems, the Tristia, lamenting the barren sands, the barbarians who threw rocks over the city walls at night, and the poor dolphins who froze to death in the ice of the winter sea so far from Rome. It's a desolate, lonely coast. It's... Good grief, it's just like Atlantic City. Casinos, high-rises, carnivals, crowds, crowds of beautiful people everywhere with dark glasses and rollerblades. This is a new look, a new generation. It occurs to Andre, a lot of these beach puppies don't remember the revolution. They've never even seen communists. Who knows what they think? He decides we will interview them.
I'm 15 years old. I go at high school. I like Britney Spears, Ricky Martin, Christina Aguilera, Backstreet Boys.
And what do you want to do when you get out of school?
I want to be a liar.
A liar?
Avocat.
Lawyer, a lawyer. It's the difference in English between lawyer and liar is very small.
There is one park in Constanza without beautiful youngsters or loud music, just the statue of Ovid. The place is as unvisited as a Latin poem. There is, however, a ghost, a 2,000-year-old gypsy who is not taking no for an answer. She's driving Andre nuts. No doubt she drove Ovid nuts, too.
Okay, Dragon.
Finally, he asks me to give her some money.
A small bill? She wants a big one, but I want a small one. Because you hold it in your hand so you can have good luck. So I could hold it, that would be my coin, my bill, so that I could take it with me and have all the things that I want. So she could tell me my name and the name of the one I love, and see all the roads and the far roads that I'm going to go on. And she knows that my eyes are laughing, but my heart is crying. And she knows that I go places. She knows lots, and she talks fast. Hello? Is this what they call the pink house?
We're heading for the mountains now.
We were told that this is a place where you have curative hydrotherapies.
The beach was nerve-wracking. Andre wants to relax.
Yes. And what sort of baths? Mineral? Yes. And massage? Yes. And electro what? Cution? Electrocution? Does that hurt?
Cebu. That's where we're going. A small town in the mountains.
How much is it? Right. And for the electrocution? Well, here we are in the medieval Gothic city of Cebu, my birthplace. Walking through the main square with the cathedral and the old tower. In my childhood, it had benches and trees. Now it's a paved cobblestone square with all the important buildings of my childhood still around it. The one on the corner there was once the headquarters of the Communist Party.
The tallest building here is a 12th century church with a clock tower.
The clock tower is how we told time, mostly because we didn't have a watch or a clock. My mother would say, go find out what time it is, and then I would go from my house. It took about 5 minutes to walk to the clock tower. And on my way home, I would meet some kid and we would talk for a while, and then I would get home, and I would tell my mother what time it was. It shows the time I read on the clock, so it was a wonderful place to grow up. Time is very flexible, and as you can see right now, it's raining. There's a hint of fall in the air, and it's the most richly poetic season for a place as old as that.
All around us are ancient homes with steep roofs and little attic windows popping out of them like eyes. Andre calls them the eyes of Sibiu.
This square had some fighting during the revolution in 1989. People were shooting from these windows of the old houses here. Houses that have a very distinguishing feature. These attics look like eyes, and you are constantly under the watch of this ancient haunted places.
Andre wants to find the Liar's Bridge. That's liar, not lawyer. It's an old stone bridge where lovers go to pledge eternal faith. Everyone in town's been on that bridge at least once, he says. But we can't seem to find it. We do run across an actual practicing liar.
4,000.
4,000. I'm going to have to get some change.
Depart.
He will get very far if we give him 4,000. He wants to go to Cluj.
No,
That's 4,000.
He's got the story that he needs to get to another city somehow to be a priest.
Yeah.
He needs to be a priest, and only 4,000 lay stand between him and priesthood.
Future priest, we just made a priest.
He tried to kiss my hand. Well, let's climb the stairs again and see if we can find the Liar's Bridge. They may have removed it during the revolution.
The hotel we're staying in is called the Imperator Romanilor, the Roman Emperor. It's not that old, just 16th century. It looks like a movie set, like the ballroom in the Titanic, with acres of crystal chandeliers and burnished mahogany and overstuffed millionaires who the audience hopes will be drowned soon. The old woman looks out of place here. She's sitting quite stiffly on the velvet couch, as if she were in church. Her hair is done carefully, and she's wearing nice clothes, her best clothes, clothes she can't afford.
The blouse she's wearing costs $1,700,000, which is her pension for a month. This is after 36 years of work. She gets 1,800,000 lei, which is about $50, yes?
She's an old friend of Andre's mother. When he was growing up here, before he got away to America, she used to help them out with food and money.
She said all summer she wasn't able to taste any fruit. She couldn't afford to buy fruit. Not a peach, not an apple.
It's one thing to be young with dark glasses and rollerblades. To be old is a great mistake.
She said winter is coming and there is no money to pay for heat. And they don't have light. They have only a single bulb and they economize. They don't turn it on.
Tomorrow we're going back to the capital, to Bucharest, so maybe somehow we could say something to somebody.
I asked her what I should ask the politicians in Bucharest, and she said, ask them how long are they going to keep us in this misery until we die of hunger.
It's raining again and growing dark, but we walk around and around and around, and all of a sudden, we stumble on the bridge.
We are on the Liar's Bridge. As I told you, the lovers go and whisper sweet nothings. Let's go to the middle. There's a great view here.
Just opposite is an old house, and from the top of the house, from the attic window, someone is watching.
Look at the old lady looking out. She's been looking out for 300 years. It's her 301st. And she's still curious. She hasn't left her place for about 150 years, but she's been looking.
She looks like she's seen everyone come across the Liar's Bridge. Romans in sandals, Germans in jackboots, gypsies with feet of silver, then communists in their dialectical slippers. And pretty soon the rollerblades will be coming. She's not going anywhere.
Her entire apartment is filled with old hourglasses and medieval clocks. She gets up in the morning and dusts her mechanical dolls, listens to the clock chimes, opens the window wide and looks out. The eyes of Sibiu watch you. The presences watching through them are old and disembodied. The ghosts are watching. The eyes of Sibiu are eternal.
Larry Massett was the narrator and producer of The Eyes of Sibiu, the story of Andrei Codrescu's return to Romania. Andrei runs the literary journal ExquisiteCorpse.org. You'll find links to all the producers you heard this hour at our website, hearingvoices.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Nina Ellis.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.